Are there any questions?
Could you explain what like R3IJK is?
Sure. So I received reports that the extrinsic curvature part was just a little confusing in general. So I thought it might help to just spend like 20 minutes just sort of recapping. And there's a notational like point of confusion that I didn't realize the first time I presented it, but I realized it when I was writing up the notes. So we talked about extrinsic curvature in two cases. The case of a, you know, I'm gonna write on this board so I can raise more boards. For a Euclidean hypersurface, which was more like motivation, because I like this geometric picture of the extrinsic curvature near maxima and saddle points. So Euclidean means that the metric is all pluses. And then the case of a 3 plus 1 dimensional spacetime with a minus sign in the metric. So in this case, the picture is that we have some n minus 1 dimensional surface in an ambient n dimensional space. And just to make the notation really general, let's assume that the subspace sigma has coordinates xi, n minus 1 coordinates, and the ambient space has coordinates x bar a. So ij and so on will be indices that run from 1 to n minus 1. And a, b, et cetera, will be indices that run from 1 to n. In this case, we make the coordinates a little bit more specialized in that we are restricting the generality to constant time surfaces defined by setting x0 to be a constant. This is not really so much of a decrease in generality so much as it is fixing notation. Since you could always, if you had a curved surface, like say a sphere, I can always choose coordinates that the defining equation looks like this. For example, in spherical polar coordinates, the equation of the sphere is r equals constant. But it does mean that the notation is different in the two cases. Okay, so in this case, I want to assume that the ambient space has some metric. G bar. And this induces a metric on sigma. That makes sense geometrically, since if I have a metric on sigma bar means that I have a notion of dot product between two vectors. And a vector on sigma is just, you know, can be viewed as a vector in sigma bar that happens to be tangent to the surface. So if I have dot products defined in sigma bar, I can also define them in sigma. But formally, the way this works, the way the inducing of a metric on a subspace works, is like this. This is called the pullback or the induced metric. And it's defined whenever you have some sort of mapping from one space to another space. In this case, this space is a hypersurface with dimension n minus 1, but it would be defined for any mapping with any number of variables on the two sides. This pullback construction can be applied whenever you have a tensor with all lower indices. Any tensor T bar living in the ambient space, if it has all lower indices, can be pulled back to the subspace. And the thing that's non-trivial here, the thing to check, is that this pullback, if I define the pullback this way, then how do its components change under changing coordinates? It turns out, if you work it out, that if I change coordinates in the ambient space, Gij doesn't change. And if I change coordinates on the subspace, if I change the coordinates xi, then Gij satisfies the usual transformation law for a tensor. So I wasn't writing these, when I was talking about this before, I wasn't writing these pullbacks explicitly or making the coordinates explicit. And I think that's that was probably notationally ambiguous. Now over here, the way that it works is that we have a space-time metric. G mu nu 4, which is a Lorentzian metric. It has a minus sign. And that induces a metric on the constant time surfaces. One way of writing this down is to say that well, we just decompose the metric into its 3+1 representation. And whatever's sitting down here in the lower 3x3 corner, lower right 3x3 corner, is the induced metric. Or another way of writing it would be, I kind of like this notation. Like this. And this follows the pullback construction with the Kronecker delta playing the role of the Jacobian. It's the pullback or induced metric. And it's Euclidean. The signs are all pluses. So in either of these situations, you could imagine two different metrics as viewed by an n observer and an n minus 1 observer. An n observer that lives in the ambient space here could take the Bard metric GAB with n components, n indices, and go on to calculate Christoffel symbols, a Riemann curvature tensor, and so on. And an n minus 1 observer who lives in the hypersurface and only has access to the unbarred metric Gij with one fewer coordinate could go on to calculate unbarred Christoffel symbols, an unbarred curvature tensor, and so on. And a question you might ask is, how do these calculations differ? How does the unbarred curvature tensor compare to the barred one? A guess which is too simple is that the unbarred curvature tensor in the hypersurface is the pullback of the barred curvature tensor in the ambient space. That's too simple as the example of a curved sphere in a flat three space shows.
Just a question.
Yes.
R and G are both defined with index down, but on the second line, you have the index down, down, like the I is on the down, and on the first line, the I is on the top. So why the definition of the pullback is not the same? You see what I mean?
Wait, sorry, can you just ask that one more time? I didn't quite get what you were asking.
Okay, so G and R are both tensors with index down. So I expect the pullback to have the same transformation rule. But the first pullback has the I on the top, and the second pullback has the I on the bottom.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Yeah, you're absolutely right. This. This equation should have been like this. Thanks. Okay. So the Gauss-Kedazzi equation says that there are these extra terms on the right-hand side, where K is a new object, the extrinsic curvature, and it's defined on sigma. There's no K-bar living on sigma bar. The way that it's defined is by taking, it's extrinsic. It's an extrinsic object in the sense that an n minus one observer that lives in sigma cannot compute k just given knowledge of their metric gij. So the definition of k, even though k is a tensor defined on sigma, is going to involve some barred stuff. One other comment is that, you know, the reason that these curvature tensors are zero is that when the n observer and the n minus one observer do these calculations, the n observer has more terms. If the n observer tries to calculate their Christoffel symbol, the barred Christoffel symbol, in the case where all the indices are spatial, then they'll end up with, you know, terms like, they'll use some formula like this. Where, when the sum over this contracted index A is written out explicitly, there will be four terms, or n terms, rather. And when the barred observer calculates their Christoffel symbol, they'll have n minus one terms, and they write out the similar equation with the unbarred metric. And likewise for the curvature tensor, there are more terms. The index contraction notation represents a sum with n terms here and n minus one terms here. So the extrinsic curvature is defined by the n minus one observer can't compute it using only unbarred quantities, but the barred observer knows about the normal vector, and can calculate the covariant derivative of the normal vector. Let's write the normal vector with a bar. just emphasize that the Bard Observer gets to write it down. So the Bard Observer can calculate this tensor and then pull it back to sigma. And that's the definition of the extrinsic curvature. And we talked about why the extrinsic curvature is capturing curvature associated with the embedding. Like if I take a flat piece of paper and I fold it, its intrinsic curvature is still zero, but it picks up extrinsic curvature in this region, in this curved region where the components of the normal vector.
If you live in the sheet of paper or whatever, you can only have access to the unbarred R. That's the only stuff you can measure. R, I, J, K, L.
That's right. That's all that you can. If you're only given the metric, if you're an unbarred observer and you're only given the metric on your space, you can compute these quantities, but not these. The extrinsic curvature, in contrast, it is defined to be a tensor that lives on sigma, with unbarred indices. But the way that it's defined involves barred quantities. It can't be computed from the metric, from the unbarred metric Bij. It's sort of like this external. In the 3 plus 1 dimensional spacetime, analogously, there's the spacetime metric G mu nu. Which you can use to compute the spacetime Christoffel symbols and the spacetime Riemann curvature as usual. And if you're just looking at a constant time snapshot and you just have the Euclidean 3 metric, then you can compute three-dimensional Christoffel symbols and three-dimensional Riemann curvature. In the spacetime case, we use 4 and 3 superscripts instead of barred and unbarred, but the idea is the same. And so there are two notions of curvature that you can compare. And they're related by a Gauss-Kadazy equation, which is all right. This way, with the Kronecker deltas playing the role of the Jacobian and the pullback. So here I've just taken the, all these Kronecker deltas are doing is just taking the space-time Riemann curvature, the 4 curvature, and just picking out the piece where all the indices are spatial. And the extrinsic curvature is a tensor that is only defined with spatial curvature. There's no notion of a K4 with spacetime indices. Just like over here, there was no notion of a K bar with indices AB. And the definition of K follows the definition in the hypersurface case, writing the Kronecker deltas explicitly. Now you often see it just written like this. Which means the same thing. You just take this spacetime tensor, this spacetime tensor with 2 Greek indices, and then just take the part of the tensor where the indices are all spatial. It's just a matter of taste whether you prefer to write it this way or this way.
And this If we work in a case where the hypersurface is a bit more complicated at constant time, then we can use the general formula with the pullback.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, then this Jacobian matrix would replace the Kronecker double. The differences between this case and this case are mostly notational, except there are some signs that are different, because here the dot product of the normal vector with itself is minus one, and over here it's plus one. So that does propagate different signs through. So the only thing that's really different about these two cases is that in the space-time case, because we've made the coordinates more specific, then we can write things down a little bit more explicitly, like we had this formula. First, we define the ADM variables by writing the metric as that's just a change of notation from, you can either represent the spacetime metric as a spacetime tensor gminu 4, or you can represent it in a 3 plus 1 dimensional way as a spatial metric plus a scalar n plus a 3 vector ni. With this definition, we can write some things down more explicitly than we could in this case, like the normal vector has the explicit form. Sometimes this is used as the definition of the ADM variables n and ni. In general, if the spacetime is curved, then the normal vector to a constant time hypersurface does not have to coincide with the coincide with the axis of the coordinate system. In other words, with the line that you draw by setting spatial coordinates constant and letting the time coordinate vary. And the ADM variables are just keeping track of that mismatch. That's one way of thinking about the ADM variables. Here's another useful formula. Another useful formula is this explicit formula for the extrinsic curvature. This one was a homework problem. And then finally, and most importantly, we have the famous ADM action. Which is a 3 plus 1 dimensional way of writing the Einstein-Hilbert action. In terms of the 3 curvature and the extrinsic curvature. Maybe I should raise this board so it's more visible. I have to cover stuff up a little. I talked about extrinsic curvature in a little more detail than we needed to. Really, for calculations, the ADM formalism can be very useful for calculations in GR because it makes it explicit which combinations of variables are non-dynamical. The n and the ni appear in the action without time derivative. So to use that formalism, you really just need these two equations, the ADM form of the action with this definition of the extrinsic curvature. And you know, just to know what notation like R3 or G3 means, if that's defined. I'd like to talk about it in a little more detail than is strictly necessary and include the geometric idea behind the definition of the extrinsic curvature and so on, because I think that's just kind of useful to know. So I think last time it just may have been confusing because of some mainly for some notational points, like these pullback Jacobians being not being written explicitly. I asked whether there were any questions, and I spent 40 minutes answering the question. But are there any other questions that anyone would like to ask? I'm almost, but not quite done talking about just general GR tools that are useful to know about. I have one more topic that I want, GR topic, which is perturbation theory in GR. And I want to start by just looking at some linear algebra identities. So I want to figure out if A and B are n by n matrices, how to expand A plus B inverse and the determinant of A and B, A plus B, as a series expansion in the matrix B. So I'm assuming that B is small. So to take the first example, if A and B are real numbers with B much less than A, then this is the series expansion. But try to generalize to matrices, then there's an ordering ambiguity. Is it the second term could be, you know, here's one possibility, or maybe this. And so I want to talk about a way that you might work out the correct right-hand side systematically. So here's one way to do it. There's more than one way to do it. But here's one chain of linear algebra tricks that I like. So you might start by just looking at the special case where A is the identity matrix. Then there'd be no ordering ambiguity, and you would expect this to be true. But that's not a proof. That's more of a plausibility argument. So one way of proving it would be to diagonalization is always a really useful trick. So if I just go to the basis where B is diagonal, then there's no problem inverting 1 plus b to get this diagonal matrix. And then I can just Taylor expand one element at a time using the Taylor series for scalars. And then I can recognize the matrices that appear as I minus b plus b squared, so on. Everything's diagonal. But this final equation is a matrix equation. And so if it's true in one basis, it has to be true in every basis. So I proved it in the diagonal basis, but because every matrix K can be diagonalized. There exists a matrix where it's diagonal. I've proved it in general. Another way to prove this, this is good. I like this chain of reasoning because it's a systematic derivation. But if you guessed that this was the answer and you wanted to prove it, another way of proving it would be to multiply both sides by I plus B. On the left-hand side, you get the identity. And on the right-hand side, you also get the identity because the terms cancel in pairs. Anyway, one way or another, we've established the right answer in the case where A is equal to I. And in the general case, you can pull out the A. I can write this as A times 1 plus A inverse B. Then the inverse of a matrix product is the product of the inverses in the other order. And then apply this formula. Get that? This is giving you the ordering of the A's and B's. And then multiplying the A inverse in, I get the correct ordering comes out, and it's the ordering is A plus B inverse. It's the ordering that you might have guessed if you had stared at this expression for scalars and then just guessed that the A's and B's would interleave each other. As an aside, that's not always right. Like, if this exponent were minus 2, then the ordering that you get on the right-hand side, you can work it out by similar reasoning. Is actually kind of a mess. All right. What a triumph of ingenuity over the failure of matrices to compute. By the way, the reason that diagonalization worked for I plus B inverse, and it didn't work here. You couldn't just diagonalize your way out of the non-commutativity here. Is that in general, given two matrices A and B, there's no basis where they're both diagonal, unless they happen to commute. Okay, how about the determinant of A plus B? This one is harder. This can also be expanded, and with some matrix A expression on the right-hand side, expanded in powers of B. One thing you can see in advance is that it's I can pull out the A again. Let me do that step first this time. So I can reduce, let's call that C. I can reduce to the case where A is the identity. Now, because there's only one matrix in the problem, I can go to the basis where that matrix is diagonal. Let's say C is a diagonal matrix. Okay. That determinant is no problem to calculate. Now I want to, over here I was trying to expand out the right-hand side somewhere and somehow and write the result in a way which is uses matrix notation and does not depend on the choice of bases. And it's not so easy to see how to do that here. The way to do it, the way to expand this out, let's just start by trying to expand it out in powers of the lambdas. One way to do that is to write it like this. Then I can expand the log in a Taylor series. Now, the lambdas are the eigenvalues of some matrix C, and I can recognize the sum of the eigenvalues as the trace of the matrix. The sum of the square of the eigenvalues as the trace of the square of the matrix. So, and then this is just x of a number. So I can expand that out in a Taylor series. I'll just write the first two terms up to order c squared. Those terms of order c cubed. This term came from, I'm writing e to the x like this. And the x squared over 2 and the expansion of e to the x is giving me this. So going back to the original, problem, the determinant of a plus b is the determinant of A times 1 plus trace of A inverse B. And you could expand out more terms if you wanted to. By the way, the first term in this expression, the linear term in B, shows that if I have the determinant of a matrix and I vary it with respect to the matrix, then this is what I get. And first order. And this was the Jacobi formula for taking the derivative of a matrix. The delta here could be any sort of derivative operator. This expansion is just producing, giving us more terms. So these formulas are going to be useful in a minute in a GR context where I'm perturbing the metric and I want to expand to beyond first order in the perturbation, and I get have terms like this that I want to expand. Then I'm going to need to know how to vary the inverse of a matrix, expand the inverse of a matrix out of the determinant of a matrix to higher than first order. So sometimes You might, for one reason or another, find yourself wanting to do perturbation theory in GR. We're going to study inflation where G bar is an FRW metric and H is some small perturbation. But you might be a black hole theorist who wants to take the Schwarzschild metric and expand it in small perturbations to see, for example, that the black hole is stable, that the equation of motion for the perturbations makes them, if I take a small perturbation of the horizon, makes that perturbation exponentially decay instead of blowing up. There was, in the first problem set, you worked out some formulas that were true to all orders in the perturbation. In other words, G and G bar could be unrelated metrics that differ by order one, and these formulas would all be correct. So just to put those formulas on the board, the first formula that I want to write down is that the difference between two connections or sets of Christoffel symbols is a tensor. That's not obvious. The transformation law for the Christoffel symbol under a change of coordinates is non-tensorial. But if I have two such objects, then I difference them, then their difference, the transformation law and their difference turns out to be tensorial. Not obvious, but if you write out the transformation laws, then can see that that's true. So in the problem set, you had two derived two formulas for C. In the case where one metric is a small perturbation of the other, then the C tensor, the Christoffel symbols would also be small perturbations of each other, and the C tensor is the difference, is the perturbation. A barred covariant derivative of the unbarred metric is not zero, vice versa. These formulas make it do show that C is a tensor, since the right-hand side is tensorial object obtained by applying covariant derivatives and subtracting tensors together. This was shown in the problem set. The other thing on the problem set were some formulas for how the Ricci curvature gets perturbed. It's useful to have two versions of the formula where barred and unbarred covariant derivatives are. This should have been six. Okay. So this topic of GR perturbation theory is quick to cover because it's just mostly a matter of building up like a library of equations that relate barred and unbarred quantities. But they do take a while to derive. Now, this was all stuff that you worked out on the problem set. There's one more formula that I want to write down, which is, so these equations are all true to arbitrary orders in the perturbation, or just for any two metrics, G and G bar, they're exactly true. Now I want to specialize to the case where the metric G is a small perturbation. Of a metric G bar, which will probably be a simple metric like FRW or Schwarzschild, and expand the, what I want to do is expand the Einstein-Hilbert action to second order in H. So the way that I'm going to do that is I'm going to write the, so mostly this is a similar sort of calculation to the problem set. I'm going to start by writing the Einstein-Hilbert action down like this. And then I'm going to expand each of these objects in powers of H. So this is where, mostly this is a mechanical calculation, it's just long. So for R mu nu, I'm gonna take this version. It'll be convenient, as you'll see in a minute, to use the version of the formula with the unbarred covariant derivative. And, let me write that step out, actually. The reason that it's convenient to use the second version is that some terms vanish by integration by parts. In the middle terms, I get an expression which vanishes by integration by parts because all objects in sight are unbarred. I have the square root of minus g, where g is the unbarred metric, g upper mu nu, the unbarred metric, times some covariant derivatives which are unbarred. That cancellation wouldn't work if I used the first version of the formula because then I would be mixing an unbarred metric with a barred covariant derivative, and there's no integration by parts formula that tells you in that case that the term is zero. Okay, so now I just want to expand each of these objects in powers of H. For example, the C tensor can be written this way. This is using the first version of the formula. So now I I'm aiming for an expression in which everything is barred except for the h. So I use the first formula here with the barred covariant derivatives.
Why do you put a bar on the first g up?
Right. Because I should have mentioned that. So I'm only expanding to first order in H here. It suffices to expand C to first order in H if I want to expand this to second order in H.
Oh, so you can.
And so to zeroth order in H, these are the same. Thanks for pointing that out. So a tricky point in this calculation is how to expand these guys in powers of H, and that was why we needed the linear algebra identities. So G upper mu nu, if I apply this linear algebra identity, where A is G lower mu nu, and B is H lower mu nu, then, sorry, where A is G bar lower mu nu, and B is H lower mu nu, then I get an identity relating G upper mu nu on the left-hand side and barred stuff on the right-hand side, which I'll write out explicitly. I'm just writing the chain of matrix multiplications on the right-hand side here in using GR notation with index contractions. That's the expansion to second order in H. So this step is really non-obvious, which is why how you do this expansion is really non-obvious, which is why I wanted to go through the linear algebra stuff. Similarly, you can show that the square root of minus g by our formula. So we had a formula relating the determinant of a plus b with the determinant of a plus b on the left-hand side. But you can easily write down an expression for the square root of minus the determinant, either by Taylor expanding the square root on the right-hand side, or just revisiting the logic with an extra square root put in. And you get some question like this. Where the dot 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 means terms of order h cubed. And so the last step is just plugging these guys in here and expanding everything out and keeping terms of order h squared. That's in principle straightforward, but it's a fair amount of algebra. I did work out all the steps in the algebra in the notes, which are taking longer than I thought to post to the wiki, but should be posted this afternoon sometime. So the result is somewhat long, but I'll write it down. This is a really general expression for a second order perturbation theory result showing how to expand the Einstein-Hilbert action to second order and metric fluctuation. Terms on the first line don't involve the object that we were calling capital C. They just come from expanding the square root minus g and the g upper mu nu. What a monster. Where all indices on the right hand side. Are raised and lowered with the Bard metric. In previous steps, I was writing those factors of the Bard metric out explicitly. But here I didn't make them explicit. I just raised and lowered the indices with the Bard metric. So many terms in here you've seen before. This is the Einstein tensor, which is supposed to appear when the Einstein-Hilbert action is expanded to first order and metric fluctuation. So that's sort of a check on this calculation. These terms you've seen before, you may have seen before if you've worked out the propagation of gravity waves in a Minkowski spacetime. These terms give the action for Minkowski where the Bard curvature is zero. These terms give the action for fluctuations in the metric, i.e. gravity waves.
Which ones? I wasn't
writing. Oh, second row. If the Bard spacetime were Minkowski, then all these terms in the top row, these are all curvature terms, which would be zero. So the second row would describe the propagation of metric fluctuations in the Minkowski background. These terms are terms that you would need are second order terms in H, and they're terms that you would need if you wanted to describe the propagation of gravity waves in a background that has curvature. I thought it was kind of interesting that this like almost Einstein tensor appeared. I don't actually quite know how to interpret this, which is probably a gap in my GR background. I did notice that forgetting about the bars for a minute. Einstein's equation is usually written this way, relating the trace reversed Ricci tensor to the stress energy tensor. You can also trace reverse both sides of the equation and write it this way, where T is the trace of T mu nu. It's just not usually done, but it's equivalent. The minus 1/4 is the way of writing Einstein's equation so it looks symmetric. I have no point in telling you this. I just thought it was sort of interesting that this tensor appeared in the calculation and it also has this property. Maybe there's some deeper meaning behind that. Okay. So that's good timing for the lecture, since these are all the sort of GR tools that I wanted to talk about. And next time we'll talk about start talking about early universe physics.